the Honorable the Speaker.
Sitting of Parliament, Thursday, 27th of June, the second reading of the Appropriation Bill continues.
Well, Mr. Speaker, after well nigh on two whole days of speeches on the Appropriation Bill, six of them from front bench opposition members and one from the Honourable the Backbencher, I think I and everybody else in the community can tell that the palpable desperation of members opposite, which was evident in the days before the last general election, is still far from dissipated, and days before the coming by-election is becoming more and more evident again. And I can understand why, Mr. Speaker. You see, Mr. Speaker, there is a notion, a well-known notion in military parlance, that attack is the best form of defence. And we've seen a whole lot of attacking from the opposition benches. Some of it wasn't even elegant attacking. I mean, it was just name calling of the worst sort. You know, people being called petty. That's the sort of level to which the debate was allowed to descend by the leader of the opposition in marshalling his troops for this debate. So in applying that military maxim, if attack is the best form of defence, if this was a defensive strategy, then it's because obviously members opposite have a whole lot of defending that they needed to do. And let me tell you in the public, Mr. Speaker, why it is that they had to do so much obvious defending. It's obvious, Mr. Speaker, that members opposite have wanted to turn this debate on the by-election, this debate on the second reading of the Appropriation Bill, into the same argument that we won at the time of the general election, with a second theme, which is that any success, any economic success of this government must reflect economic success of the government of Gibraltar up to the 8th of December 2011, and any health of public finances today must reflect health of public finances as of the 8th of December 2011. And the thing is developed, Mr. Speaker, by talking about a big lie. Now, of course, lying is not something that one talks about in this House, it's not parliamentary language. But honourable members have been deploring the concept of the big lie during the course of their campaign and referring to it in the context of their speeches, but not calling us liars, simply referring to the big lie. So, fair enough. I mean, that is this language which is now acceptable as long as we're not calling each other liars, and I think that is absolutely appropriate. So, the whole argument is the big lie was developed by the now Chief Minister, the leader of the opposition, in telling people that debt was too high and that public finances were not sound. They say, as part of their theme, public finances were healthy when the GST left power. And that, therefore, is the big lie. And they say that the evidence that this was a big lie is the health of public finances today. Okay. Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? I mean, they've got no arguments left. They said it last year during the course of this debate. The whole debate last year was based on that premise, as far as they were concerned. They said it again this year. And it was boring and repetitive, and our people deserve better. That's about all that the GOP can dish up these days, trying to rerun the argument that they lost in December 2011. Well, I'm surprised that they wanted to run that argument for a second year running and on the eve of a bad election. It might have been the easy way out of writing speeches to challenge what is undoubtedly the best budget in the world of history. I mean, with nothing left to say, attack is the best form of defense. But none of them know the reality of the health of public finances today, and the power state of public finances on the 8th of December 2011, I'm surprised that they were lazy enough to go for that tactic and not be a bit more imaginative. At least they made my job easier when deciding how to reply to their remark. You see, Speaker, even the members of it, who were not in government up to the 8th of December 2011 and didn't make it through the glorious new dawn of the morning after, even those, even the rookies, even the new boys, they never know the reality. Because I took them through it step by step last year. Because it's black and white in the estimate book that they try to ignore. They've seen the transformation of the figures. If they've looked at the figures, because as I say when I come to deal with Mr. Figueroa's intervention, he didn't mention one number. He didn't talk about one figure in the context of a speech on the appropriation bill. So look at maybe, but he didn't look at the book. He didn't look at the schedule to the bill that we're discussing. But the others are assumed, at least in your position, did it the courtesy of doing an analysis, or a flaw that I may believe it was, of the figures. So they cannot pretend, Mr. Speaker, that they don't know what the numbers are, and that they've given their speeches in ignorance. They cannot pretend that they trusted Sir Peter Cabrera to tell them what the figures were, because they've got an obligation as members of this House to look at the schedule for the bill, which is the estimates book. And if they've got memory, they will remember all I told them last time. Even if they wanted to disregard everything I said during the general election campaign, they must have heard what I said in my speech last year when I introduced the bill, in my speech last year when I replied to them, in my speech this year when I introduced the bill. Although, of course, as the leader of the opposition said, nothing I said would change the same as what he had to say. Of course, my UK would have prepared checks. And I should have said, Mr. Speaker, that Gibraltar had staked £1 on the Texan lottery and we'd won $2 billion. And all our problems were solved. The leader of the opposition was going to give the same speech that he turned up with in his prepared checks. But they never heard the argument. And so one has to assume that knowing the argument, they have to somehow find a way around this brilliant budget. And the only way that they could do that was to concoct a rule. A rule that gives them a way around the brilliant budget. Something of a deceptive narrative that is going to be enough to paper over the clock and not result in a complete demolition of support for them at the next general election. This is an exercise in simply trying to stay alive on polling day next week. It's not more than that. It's not trying to win. It's simply trying to stay alive. But if you think of it, with the figures available, the general public, not that many would be interested, but the general public, if they are interested in looking at the numbers, will see that this is definitely a deception. Well, their game's up, Mr. Speaker. This is the end of the rule. You see, Mr. Speaker, in the context of the speeches that we heard, Mr. Clinton said that he was going to demonstrate things. But he did nothing of the sort. He just argued his way around figures. Then Mr. Messina said that he was going to prove things. I didn't seem to prove anything. I heard him try and develop an argument around very difficult figures that were close and challenged, obviously. How can we deal with the largest ever increase in Gibraltarians in employment in history when you're representing the party that only brought 22 new jobs for Gibraltarians a year into our economy, when one of the giants of Gibraltar politics has managed to create 524 in 1 year? They didn't prove anything, didn't demonstrate anything in their argument. But as usual, Mr. Speaker, I will be different. I will demonstrate things during the course of this reply to that argument. And I will demonstrate it with documentary evidence. I will put things beyond argument. Not just with the estimates book that they've chosen to ignore. Because you people will look at it. And they have banked on that, Mr. Speaker. They've banked on the fact that members of our community are not going to look at the estimates book. But they aren't going to try and take them to one particular figure down now. So that they could argue whatever they like. But I'm now going to demonstrate, prove, evidence. Using evidence from the Treasury and from the Ministry of Finance, that the GSB left Gibraltar and its public finances in the most dire situation imaginable. I will make an argument. I will not try to persuade them. I will demonstrate the position to the South and to the general public so that they know what they're dealing with. And when I do that, Mr. Speaker, I will never debunk the argument that the election was a big lie. I will have demonstrated who told the lie. Now, Mr. Speaker, because of the original thought on the bench of representatives, the credit of the big lie, as you know better than us, is one that comes from the early 70s of an election held then. 72, the 1972 election. An election which will become relevant again when I reply to Mr. Figueroa. But it was actually the winning side that demonstrated that a lie had been told about them. A winning side with which Mr. Speaker would have a great affinity, I believe it was his first entry into Parliament. And that's what I'm going to demonstrate today. That the big lie has been told about us by them, Mr. Speaker. So, without further ado, let us do the debunking, the demonstrating, the proving, and the evidencing. So, okay, we said during the general election campaign, I started saying it here, through the budget debate of 2011, that Gibraltar's net debt was too high. And we said that gross debt was too high. And the Honourable, the then Chief Minister, now the backbencher's argument was that the measure of debt was such that it was not too high as a ratio of GDP. There's an argument. People could take it or leave it. They had a choice. This is a democracy. Up to there, arguments based on public members. Then we're elected. And I find myself in a situation where I have to make an address to the nation, a ministerial statement to the nation in early January 2012. And you see that they mocked that ministerial statement as much as they could. They talk about me putting on a solemn face. They do everything possible to try and make people think that what I said there should not be relied on. And because that sometimes it is difficult to remind honourable members that I do some things as leader of the GSOP and I do some things as Chief Minister of Gibraltar. And I did that ministerial statement as Chief Minister of Gibraltar, not as leader of PSFP. I was talking to all our citizens and for all our citizens. And I told our people then to illustrate the state of public finances when we took over, that the notion of a golden legacy left by the GFC is just completely untrue. But I'm going to do an analysis of the legacy that the GFC left Gibraltar on the 8th of December 2011 when I deal with Mr. Buffino's intervention. Because he's the one that seems still so much in the thrall of Sir Peter that he still feels he needs to talk about where a great judge is, despite the obvious betrayal at leadership election time. So, how is it that I can demonstrate that the economic legacy, the public finance legacy, was not a golden legacy? That there was not enough available cash reserve to meet outgoings for that financial year without more borrowing? Honourable members will no doubt have had their side as we had ours, following us down the estates to hear what we had to say. And I said during the course of the 2011 general election campaign that if honourable members opposite were elected, they could not carry out anything in their manifesto other than by increasing debt. And to put very simply, Mr. Speaker, I used to say the way that they're going to finance their manifesto is D-E-B-T, debt. I used to spell it out, Mr. Speaker, in case people didn't manage to grasp it. My goodness, Mr. Speaker, was I right or was I right? But how can I demonstrate it, Mr. Speaker, beyond peradventure? Not by making arguments as they do on numbers. How can I prove this in a way that puts it beyond doubt completely? Well, very simple, Mr. Speaker. I am today publishing memoranda from the Treasury that demonstrate the position as at that moment in time. Members of the community will no longer have to decide if they think Bikaiga is right or Putin is right. They won't have to try and work out which side is dissembling or trying to distort figures. No longer will people have to think about whether they trust the GSB or the GSLP liberals who have told the truth on the argument. It's too unfair on our people not to clarify the position beyond doubt. We've gone beyond that now. It's too important, Mr. Speaker, because they've made this the central issue in the public debate, and their attempt to weave a web of deceit around this issue must be now dealt with. So I sought the consent, Mr. Speaker, of the Financial Secretary. And I am therefore taking the unprecedented step of immediately putting into the public domain two memoranda from the Treasury. The first is a note prepared by the Financial Secretary himself and dated the 8th of December 2011. The Chief Minister on that day, the day of the election, was the Honourable Peter Caplan, as he then was. Wasn't, people might think, a day when there isn't a Chief Minister. There is a Chief Minister on the day of the election. In fact, even after the vote accounted, there is a Chief Minister until a new Chief Minister is sworn in. And the first memorandum that I am putting into the public domain is dated the 8th of December 2011. The note sets out the exact position of public finances on that date. It's a snapshot of Gibraltar's public finances on that date, which the Financial Secretary has made available to me, and which is put on a file, I think very wisely, so that it's beyond argument that the position on that day, on the day of the election, the day before potentially take over by a new government is set by him in effect in stone and put beyond discussion. A copy of it will be circulated to all the media in Gibraltar and made available on the government website so that the whole of our community can look at it. It's a one-page document, Mr. Speaker, and it reflects the Financial Secretary's calculation and his conclusions on that day, on the day that Gibraltar was voting, on the day that they were hoping to have persuaded Gibraltar that its public finances were stronger than ever, and the day they were boasting of the health of our public finances. And this backdrop tells the real picture. A very, very bleak picture indeed. Because this document, Mr. Speaker, reflects £20 million only on the 8th of December of available cash reserves. Mr. Speaker, in 1998, £20 million might have taken you a long way between December and March, the end of the financial year. In 2011, £20 million in December, in mid-December, with the December payroll today and three more today, with capital expenditure commitment of £87 million rising to £100 million before the end of the financial year, on a budget of £450 million, even members opposite would be able to work out £20 million would not have got us to the end of the financial year on the 31st of March. Exhibit A, the Financial Secretary's note of the 8th of December. But with the feedback, the second document is dated the 13th of December, 5 days later. It is a document, Mr. Speaker, that I will remember for the rest of my life. I call it, Mr. Speaker, the Doomsday Memo. I don't think we had the opportunity of enjoying our first Christmas as ministers, Mr. Speaker, relaxing after an arduous election campaign, and settling in with our family for what might have been a celebration after 16 years of being in opposition. Because this document, addressed to me, Mr. Speaker, came 4 days after I was sworn in as Chief Minister, less than 24 hours after the Deputy Chief Minister and I had assigned portfolios to honourable members on this side of the House, less than 24 hours after the first cabinet meeting of the new GSLP Liberal government, I received the Doomsday Memo from the Financial Secretary. Of course, at that stage, I don't know about the memo that he put on the file on the 8th of December. I'm saying that I wasn't used at that time to receiving correspondence addressed to the Chief Minister. I almost felt as if I could send it to the Honourable Sir Peter Cahuana at Irish Town, curious when I was first elected to receive letters addressed to the Chief Minister. You know, for a moment, Mr. Speaker, I wish it had been addressed to the Honourable Sir Peter Cahuana rather than to me. I wish I had not been the recipient of this memorandum. The document in question, Mr. Speaker, has said also from the Financial Secretary, set out the calculations done by Mr. Dayaram Tirada on that day, the 13th of December, 5 days after the 8th of December. I don't stop telling them the numbers, Mr. Speaker, because they obviously have an issue with numerology. 5 days later, He told you, Mr. Speaker, in that doomsday memo, that the actual figure of gross debt is £520 million. Not the public figure estimated of £480 million, which is where the GSE had told us we were going to be in March 31st, 2012. Not that figure of £480 million, which was anticipated. £520 million. And I recall, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Mr. Keith Appleby said, I don't know whether they caught it on camera or not, during the course of the leaders' debate on the night of the 7th of December, Honourable members will know that is the one leaders' debate which they didn't object to Mr. Appleby attending. And they talk about being so democratic, but they didn't like people interfering with their leaders' debate. When in 2007 they prevented Mr. Appleby from attending that debate. In 2011 he was there. The Honourable, and now the backbencher, the then Chief Minister, was there. And of course, I was there. And during the course of that debate, hours before the polls opened, the Honourable then Chief Minister said, oh, by the way, the gross debt is £580 million. I don't know what my face looked like, but I always remember what Mr. Fabazi's face looked like. Because both our faces fell. There was a book published that told the general public in an election year that the gross debt was going to go up to a maximum of £480 million by the 31st of March 2012. And it had gone up to £520 million on the day of the election, still 4 months away. Talk about spending being out of control. Anyway, when one is seeing the doomsday memo, it's quite enjoying being Chief Minister for those 72 hours between the swearing in and the speech of it. There is one thing that just literally out of the plane. I didn't know about the memo of the 8th of December, but in the memo of the 13th of December, total available cash reserves, Chief Minister, to get you to the end of the financial year, Chief Minister, at £60 million. In 5 days, between the 8th of December and the 13th of December, usable cash reserves have gone down by £4 million. We haven't even at that stage spent money on more wine guns for number 6 from the club. And there it is, Mr. Speaker. Black upon white, no room for doubt, no room for argument. The debate is no longer about which politician you can trust. This is the unadulterated reality of public finances on the 13th of December 2011. The unimpeachable truth of public finances on the 13th of December 2011. I can see that the Honourable here, the opposition, is laughing nervously. You know, I wondered why Mr. Cabrana might have favoured one or the other, and I don't know whether it was he thought he was giving Mr. Messina the poison chalice of the employment portfolio, or whether it's Mr. Cabrana who's given Mr. Peter the poison chalice of having to defend this. There's always usually, Mr. Speaker, an interim leader that loses the next one before the favoured leader comes through. We've seen it everywhere else. So I understand and entirely, and I forgive them completely for their nervous laughter at this difficult juncture. On the eve of the by-election campaign, to see the whole thrust of your argument centered with evidence must be hard. I feel for them, but I understand how nervous they must feel. Because if you need to think that the state of public finances of Gibraltar, when the GSC left office, was very, very precarious indeed. Probably more precarious than ever. And let me do a basic calculation for the general public and for the government. When we took over, assuming that on the 9th in the morning, when we were sworn in at 10 o'clock, I was sworn in as Chief Minister, other members were sworn in as ministers, not yet with portfolios. Let's assume that it's still 20 million. Same as on the 8th. So the day we take over is £20 million available cash reserve. That means, Mr. Speaker, and they've got to understand this, that we were £20 million away from breaching the statutory limit prescribed under something called the Borrowing Powers Act for the financial year 2011-2012, the Public Finance Borrowing Powers Act. 4 days later, the usable cash is reduced to £15 million. I don't know if the Honourable Members of the House have an estimate for prison. But of course, if they don't, already think what they're debating about. I'm not surprised, Mr. Speaker, given that we haven't heard much analysis of the numbers. Other than, of course, I expect from the leader of the opposition, who did an analysis, which I think is flawed, but he did an analysis, and he's now showing me he has the book. I think he's going to wish he didn't have it. If I tell you to page 3 of the book, Mr. Speaker, the actual position of net public debt on the 31st of March 2012 is the extreme right column and the second row for the public debt is £303.4 million. The ceiling of net public debt for that year was £306 million. Do they understand, Mr. Speaker, that therefore the position in which we inherited the public finances of Gibraltar saw us find ourselves as at that date with £2.1 million of available cash reserve? Thank goodness that there was a new dawn on the 8th of December, and that from a position, a record low that we inherited from the GSB, available cash reserves now up to £85 million. £85 million given to community care, which they have brought down to zero. The second part of the Doomsday Memorandum of the 13th of December is that the Financial Secretary recommends that I should come to the House and seek an urgent resolution from the House in order to enable the further drawing on cash reserves to meet ongoing capital expenditure commitments and ensure that there is sufficient cash to meet day-to-day government business. That's the effect of the low available cash reserve. But you haven't got the money to meet day-to-day government business commitments and capital expenditure commitments. That's the situation in which they put us. And there's no point pretending, Mr. Speaker, if they are now seriously going to go down that route again without waiting a year for people to forget the argument that they had this time, that they didn't know that this was the case. Although they seem to be pouring over the numbers now, thinking, oh my goodness, is this actually true? Perhaps now that the people is not there and they're doing their own calculations for themselves, they're thinking to themselves, oh damn it, he's right. But they can't pretend that they didn't know. Because they campaign on the basis of the health of the economy and the health of public finances during the general election. And they've done it again this time. Everything you're achieving. The health of public finances today, those yourself liberals, you are achieving because of the golden legacy that we left you. The golden legacy that we left you. And it is stupid enough to hear that, Mr. Speaker, after I've told them what debt they fit to philosophy in terms of public finances, then perhaps the rest of what I'm going to say is flawed because they must have been lobotomized. They know, Mr. Speaker, because the £520 million of public debt was disclosed by the Honourable then Chief Minister on television on the leading debate the night before the election. And I assume that unless they had other agendas, they were all watching their then glorious leader in glorious Technicolor on analog GBC as it then was with the popcorn and enjoying every minute of it. So they must have heard him say £520 million. The second, Mr. Speaker, was that in a fairly fiery and combative speech at a state occasion like the ceremonial opening of the Parliament, the honourable gentleman who was then the leader of the opposition didn't simply concede the point. He insisted, perhaps like a Pied Piper that wants to keep his fans happy, or a David Koresh that has managed to convince people of his messianic quality, that everything was all right, but there was a string in the fall of his argument on public finances. He said, and if you need a resolution of this House, if you need any instrument of this House in respect to public finances, we will, of course, support you. Well, that might have passed me by at a different time. But in receipt of the Doomsday Memo, I knew exactly what he was talking about, and he knew exactly what the position was. Exactly what the position was. Whatever parliamentary approval you may require as the government for additional borrowing, we would be happy to provide. And then after I do my ministerial statement, in his reply, artfully done, because he admits everything I say, but then says that what I'm saying is not true, artfully done, he said, explicitly, if I had been elected, I would have sought the resolution of the House to extend the borrowing limit beyond the £20 million available on the 8th of December. So they must have known, Mr. Speaker, what the position was, because their then glorious leader was telling them. With all of that evidence, and it takes 2 minutes for them to see that their budget the year before was the £450 million for the year 2011-2012, they must now realize that to fund the growth of public finances in a state where there was only £15 million available, or 3.5% of the budget for the year on the day that you are elected, was a matter of very grave concern indeed. not expect to save cost more than $16 million between December and the end of March, Mr. Speaker. And the Office of Justice was inconsistent with the estimate. The estimate that had been presented to the House, on which the election was fought, with only one figure difference from the last night, 12 hours or 9 hours before the poll opened, which is when the then leader of the party opposite dropped the clangor of the £520 million. The estimate showed an end of year gross public debt of $480 million and usable cash reserves of $90 million. That's what their estimate showed. So imagine in that context, Mr. Speaker, receiving the doomsday memo. On the 9th of December, Mr. Speaker, one of the things that the Financial Secretary said to me was he then put in this memo, just as a briefing, so that one is aware of what is happening, was that the advance to wholly owned government companies stood at £87 million, and by the end of the financial year would be £100 million. Mr. Khan himself accepts that that is the case, but says, you know, this would have been covered as we sold assets to cover this £100 million. Well, look, if you owe somebody £100 million and you say you're going to pay it by the 31st of March, and you don't pay it by the 31st of March, and you turn up in the office of the person who lent you the money, and you say, well, you know, Peter, don't worry, I'm going to sell stuff to be able to pay you. The response would likely be, hang on, Paul, the whole point of you lending me the money was that you would have sold all of those assets or paid me otherwise by today's date. If you can't pay me, you have got a £100 million hole in your balance sheet. And that is exactly what we found, Mr. Speaker. And that is also reflected in the doomsday memo and in the information provided to the government. Because, of course, how can one repay £100 million if all you've got is £16 million available? You can't even, and that's the company, but you can't even give the companies the fair advance that they need, because they don't have to spend that £100 million before the 31st of March. You've only got 16 left. If you give them 13 to take them up to the £100 million that they need, you've got 3 left for the rest. So, it's hard to know. And I have to say, I salute his style. How he was able to admit everything in his response, and then say that it wasn't true. And then simply say, in respect of the £100 million, so it's just a cash flow issue. Well, it was a figure. I'd like to explain, I'd like to see any politician explain to the hard-working public servants of Gibraltar on payday that there isn't enough money to pay them because of a cash flow issue. That would be fun. But that's what they put into this figure. They put it almost in La Linea territory. Or perhaps to our contractors, which is speaking within the capital project, and say to them, well, we've done all the work, but I can't pay you, but don't worry. It's just a cash flow issue. But isn't it always just a cash flow issue? I don't have the cash because it's not flowing. Isn't that the debtor's usual disclosure, Mr. Speaker? So if they want to go out campaigning, saying that there was not this black hole, if that candidate in this general, this by-election campaign says that there was no black hole in our public finances, and that we told a big lie, after he sees the doomsday memo, and the memo of the 8th of December 2011, and after he sees page of the estimate, which I am personally going to send her with a copy of my reply, because I think she deserves it. I think she deserves to have the facts and not be led up the garden path by honourable members opposite. Then I dare say she may want to stand as an independent this time round, rather than as two or three to be an independent and not have to defend the indefensible with very alumbered room. And I'm going to send her this material because she's still got time to say to people that she will not take their wit if elected, because what they have done is so disgraceful in the attempt to pull the wool over people's eyes, but she will have no part of it. Because people, when we were elected, we decided we did not want to take the advice of the financial secretary and come to the House for a resolution to increase our borrowing. Our manifesto was about reducing gross debt and net debt. We were not going to increase gross debt further. So we didn't come here to seek the resolution. It's also a priority of our government, nonetheless, to have increased available, usable cash reserve to an appropriate level, as we set out in our manifesto. So what did we do? What have we done? How did we make it to the end of the year? Very simple. As honourable members know, and as the general public knows, we have to stop the capital project. If you haven't got the money, you stop spending. It's the only answer. And I said to the general public that we would do that. In my ministerial statement, this is the state of our finances. This is what we have to do. We have to stop spending. I would love a tunnel under the runway. And so much more. I'd love a runway that extends into the Mediterranean and can take the Airbus A380. Mr. Speaker, you have to spend within your limits and not allow yourself to do what honourable members do. And you have to spend on things which produce income or which have a social benefit for the community. Not a vanity project. So I immediately said, with the support of my cabinet, we're stepping these capital projects. We didn't buy any more lavish public toilets. We didn't invest any more in a new theatre at the Theatre Royal Park, as it has become. We stopped all of the waste, Mr. Speaker. We started to recalibrate what Gibraltar spends hard-earned taxpayers' money on. So when all the members of it talk about the public finances that we inherited not needing curing, and I saw that we got that, Mr. Speaker, from the Honourable Sir Peter Kahwana, who's defending his record, from the Honourable Venara, Leader of the Opposition, who is trying to make a go of it, and from the Honourable putative other Leader of the Opposition, Mr. Casino, who is just here positioning himself to say that he also defended the glory of the GSU when the time for the next leadership election comes. When they say that there was nothing to fear, they know now, Mr. Speaker, that what they're saying was not accurate. They must have known it before if they've given it a carefully look in the book. They must have known it before if they read between the lines of what the Honourable, the then Leader of the Opposition, said in reply to my ministerial statement. But now, Mr. Speaker, even those will be able to understand, see, and appreciate exactly what the position was, demonstrated black upon white in the two memoranda of the financial secretary that we will be publishing today. They will see that there was a serious public debt problem. A serious problem where the government elected found itself with very little cash in hand to continue the day-to-day business of government, let alone fund many of the ongoing capital project. they will see if they want to see, Mr. Speaker. The blind sometimes do not want to see. But there was a £100 million spending in government-owned companies, which the companies did not have the ability to repay to the government. The uncontrolled level of capital expenditure incurred by the previous administration in the year leading up to the general election. But they know, Mr. Speaker, because I told them last year that they had managed to spend more, the figure may be right, in the last 2 years before the general election than they had spent in the previous 13 on capital projects. That smells like desperation. Desperation is hang on. But Mr. Speaker, the important thing to tell the general public, apart from the fact that the case is now put beyond doubt in the documentation issue, is that the matter has been dealt with. The matter has been dealt with to such an extent that they can have absolute confidence in the excellent state now of Gibraltar's public finances and that they are only getting better. Usable cash reserves are restored. We now have, as I told the House earlier, £85 million. Both growth and public debt are on the way down. Other members say the growth debt is not the measure that's relevant. Well, we say it is in part relevant, and it's down by 27.5%. That is, net debt is the relevant measure. Net debt will be down by 10%. On the numbers given to them in this estimate book by the end of this financial year. Public finances are now 18 months later well enough to be able for us to embark full steam ahead with the implementation of our manifesto commitments and to target spending where we said we would target it for the benefit of our community. And we were pleased a record budget surplus in spite of the increases in recurrent expenditure. Because, of course, there have been increases in recurrent expenditure in the public service. They didn't employ people to fill vacancies for years. When you get people to fill the vacancies in the civil service, of course your payroll goes up. But the alternative is for them to be honest and say, look, we're not going to fill the vacancies. We have increased spending on health, on education, 47 more teachers. None of them would like to go up and say, recurrent expenditure is up in the public sector. But what he doesn't like to do is to stand up in this house with the courage of his convictions that he's got them and say, and therefore, because we don't agree with recurrent expenditure being up in the public sector, we will once again get rid of those 47 new teachers that Gilbert is dealing with, teaching his work and employ as permanent and pensionable as soon as they as we were elected under the new public sector arrangement. It is a question of which hands of the hare and one with the hounds. We want to say to the Chamber of Commerce, we are your angels of vigilance on the increase in recurrent public spending. And we want to say to the people who are getting the jobs, we support you getting the jobs, even though Sir Peter didn't open any vacancies in the civil service for the past 4, 5, or 8 years. We don't want to be going through the Public Services Commission, where it's so much easier to do things as ever, as I'll demonstrate later, when I'm dealing with the foolish remarks about cronyism that opened the back flank that was put together. But recurrent expenditure, Mr. Speaker, is restored to affordable levels and is aligned with our manifesto commitment to keep recurrent expenditure growth below the growth in the economy and limited to an increase of 40% in our first term of office. Our members can see that the growth in departmental expenditure for 2013-14 is expected to be about 5% over the previous year's figures, which is significantly less than the growth in the economy. I don't know why it is that they feel that they can go around talking about things being unaffordable. Well, I know they don't like to listen, and they'd rather read messages from the sycophants that say, don't worry, you're still alive. You'll find something to say, you'll be able to talk your way out of it. But if they bother to listen, they might not make the same mistake again. It may be worth them listening. It may be worth them trying to come to terms with the fact that they have been outed. That the truth is not just out there, it's out here and available to all our citizens now for them to see. That this proves the serious problem that Gibraltar has, and it proves in these estimates how we cured it. And of course, it proves that they cannot be trusted. This, Mr. Speaker, is a political slam dunk of evidence that demonstrates that the only credible version of the state of Gibraltar's public finances at the time of the election was the one that we were telling before the election from our analysis and have been telling since. The facts have betrayed the deceit in their arguments outside of the camp. The numbers, Mr. Speaker, in the estimates book demonstrate that their words are totally and entirely unreliable. And the public must know now that they can never again be trusted. And their candidates for this by-election will want to think again about whether he defends the indefensible record of the GSC or goes back to independent thought. Can you save now, Mr. Speaker, 18 months, a huge amount of money by not continuing with the projects that honourable members were embarked upon? We continue spending on some capital projects and, of course, the recurrent expenditure, although the honourable leader can sometimes have difficulty understanding the difference between the two. But there'll be no spending on vanity projects, Mr. Speaker. We spent wisely in 18 months, and we saved wisely in 18 months. And much of what is delivered these excellent results. There is no magic to it. I know that they can't quite work out how they're going to afford our manifesto, but it is pretty simple, and I hope that today, by having told them what I told them, they will start to be able to realize that continuing to argue that we cannot afford our manifesto and eventually let a lot of people down may be an easy way of getting around a question time that's looming or an argument that's looming. But it may be an argument that comes back to bite them in their political experience at the time of the next general election, if we have delivered and if we have afforded. So it is a high-stakes game that they're playing. I can tell them, and I can tell them all, that we know how we're going to deliver, we know when we're going to deliver, and we're going to know exactly where the money is coming from. So they may want, although it's not that I'm loath to give them advice, it's not my job to do so, they may want to recalibrate their arguments, but we have to recalibrate spending, because they may find themselves in a very difficult position at the time of the next general election. The leader of the opposition may find themselves in a very difficult position at the time of the next general election. In fact, the leader of the opposition may find themselves in a very difficult position the day after the by-election, but never mind that. But anyway, Mr. Speaker, he said himself, during the course of his early intervention, that nothing I said was going to change what he thought of the numbers and what he was going to say to the general public, so I guess he's probably not listening to this. Because if it was hard to listen to me, give a speech explaining what a brilliant budget to Gibraltar is going to benefit from, it must be even harder to hear me deconstruct and demonstrate that the whole basis of the arguments that they've put today are really no longer sustainable. And I recognize, Mr. Speaker, that, and I have some sympathy with, colleague of the opposition, because answering the debate on an appropriation bill, you know, second reading, is the hardest job in parliamentary politics. Not just in this parliament, but in all parliaments. Everybody has more time to prepare, the leader of the nation needs to get up and respond. He needs to respond almost on the hoof, you know, in a moment. He needs to assimilate the arguments put by the leader of the House and reply. The standing orders say that we cannot read speeches, because the speeches are liberal in this debate in particular, to allow members to read speeches, of course, and it is normal, even for leaders of the opposition, to turn up with some prepared arguments. That's why leaders of the opposition and members of the opposition are given on a confidential basis the schedule to the bill to allow them to prepare. But there are some things that are in the gift of the Chief Minister to stay only in this House on the day of the bill, and there has to be a reaction to that. And therefore, a leader of the opposition cannot rely entirely on his prepared remarks. He has to really show that spark in answering the recalibration of taxation and import duties and benefits that the Chief Minister does here on the day of the debate. But he did none of that, Mr. Speaker. He gave us his prepared text. A relatively flat, I mean, I didn't think Mr. Fidel said anything worth people listening to, but his speech was anything but flat. I mean, it was so riddled with factual inconsistencies, which I'll go through one by one, that at least it created a stir. And the honorable leader of the opposition speech will probably, as flat as the Pope one drinks when one has got a tummy problem and one is age 3. At least he would have thought that in his maiden speech as leader of the opposition, he would have gone for some big punch. I wasn't even that. Just, you know, with their big election thing. But look, Mr. Speaker, he wasn't intending to listen to reason. He wasn't going to deal with anything he said. He wasn't going to say anything about the fact that the numbers are exactly as we predicted in our manifesto they would be, that the tax cuts were as we predicted they would be. He wasn't going to say anything about us having reduced the debt or about having reduced net debt. I mean, he couldn't really say, although I don't think they're relevant, I recognize that debt is down 57.5% in growth and it's going to be down 10% in net. He could say something. He could say, look, I recognize you've given £35 million to community care. That's not a bad thing. He said, Mr. Speaker, before the election, that our manifesto was the longest suicide note in history. Well, look, let me just pause there on the phrase. The Honourable Member is not known for his original thought, but for a man who purports to be of the left, to enjoy quoting Margaret Thatcher's remarks of Michael Foot's Labour Manifesto of 1982 is a bit rich. But it's interesting even following that, because the new mantra of this culture of entitlement, where this is for working families, for people who work up in the morning. I couldn't believe when I heard him the other day on BBC say, this is for people who wake up in the morning and go to work while others curtain to slow down. Because the absence of original thought first manifested in the appeasing factor, which like Sapita used to do when he was in the opposition, and he used to copy almost word for word for Paddy Ashdown, is now manifesting itself again in the honorable leader of the opposition, quoting George Osborne. Every single word that he used in that particular interview with GBC was word for word George Osborne on Radio 4 a month before. Let's assume, Mr. Speaker, that it just swept into his subconscious as he was walking past the radio that somebody else was listening to. But if he still wants to pretend to be a man of the left, can he at some stage please do me the pleasure of quoting someone from the left? even if they're original thought, actually it's probably better than voting than the original thought. The last time the honourable gentleman came up with any original thought, he was going to introduce capital gains tax to Gibraltar and abolish category 2 status. So better know original thought and keep quoting what you read in the newspapers, Mr. Speaker. But anyway, apart from what he called suicide note, which turned out to be the successful manifesto, which our discerning electorate decided should be the one that for the government, the best manifesto ever presented to the people of Gibraltar. The suicide note has become dangerous and undeliverable. And that's why that tactic, I'm telling him, is going to be fought for. What are you going to do, Mr. Speaker, in the next general election? Will he at least commit himself, if he is still leader of the GOP then, will he at least commit himself to stay on the legal debate? So again, I want to start this debate by acknowledging that you have completed what I described as the most ambitious manifesto in the history of Gibraltar, completely, that you have delivered what I said could not be delivered, that you have afforded what I said was not affordable, and that your credibility in this debate is much higher than mine. Let's now get on to the issues going forward. But going forward, and he likes to say balancing. He doesn't like to say going forward. Okay, let's look at the arguments going balancing. Right? But we're here to discuss all of that. Okay. He calls the increase in the public sector, in the recurrent cost of the public sector, ruinous. But I would say, if that's his position, it's his position. But even if his deputy's position, did I say deputy when I was referring to the Honourable Mr. Bettina? I shouldn't have. I understand he still has no deputy, although he was deputy. There was still no deputy. I'm going to appoint a leader, a deputy leader. I know that the competition is fierce. Competition is good for the soul. And that it's a bit, at the moment, the law of the jungle on the other side. So, his next deputy, his first putative deputy, or his first putative alternative leader, Mr. Bettina, agreed with him expressing the concern of the increased cost of public sector. Again, I think we have shown up. But it's fine that you can say that. And you know, it's still original thought. Okay? So let us work through that original thought. Let's take it to its natural consequence. Let me say to them, because they obviously don't have the courage to say it, let me say to every member of the GDCA and Unite, this government remains committed to peer review in Gibraltar, which reflects in their salary the performance, always positive, of the Gibraltar Fund. This government remains committed to the public service review, and we remain committed to the manning levels of the civil service, and to providing a more efficient service to the public, and to citizen solutions. But then it still fails from the numbers' arguments what they believe. Dear members of Unite and GDCA, and of course because we have the issue of the 47 teachers, dear members of the teachers union as well, Mr. Peter, the current leader of the opposition, apparently Mr. Cohen is to be being called the current Chief Minister, but we all have to accept that we are current. The current leader of the opposition, Mr. Peter, and Mr. Bettina, the political leader of the opposition, both think that we are already employing too many people and paying you all far too much this year because the recurring cost of the public sector has gone up. At least, members of the public sector is that everybody know what their position is in respect of employment and remuneration. And in terms of the manager's service, as an aside, so where is the GSC going? The increase in the current cost of the public sector, of course, includes the 2.9% increase in salaries paid to public servants. Well, obviously, by saying that the recurrent expenditures went up, necessarily against that. But I didn't agree. Strategia agreed it. In the 3-year review, which he left me. And I was fine with it. I was fine with the fact that he left me those training pieces that our hard working public servants deserve. I just wasn't fine with the fact that he didn't leave me any money to pay for it. But then I'm now saying that the cost of the public sector is going up too much. It is going up 5%. 2.9% of that goes to salaries. And it's an increase that they agreed. So where is the GSD? Is the GSD where it was? Agreeing these increases? Or is that another one of the repositioning moves that Mr. Featon is doing of the party? I'll come to some of the others later. Well, what they should have done on recurring expenditure is recognize that overall recurrent expenditure has been controlled like never before. They've brought it in on budget. But we then went on to talk about the increased cost of legal advice from the private sector. Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to refer him to which firm received what amount. But let me tell him, and let me tell them all, that they need to understand that a culture of compliance, which is a badge of honor for Gibraltar, and enables us to achieve the things that we have achieved which eluded them, like the code group and the ECOFIN approval, cost money. We've recruited more people to the EUID and to the LSU. Of course, the current expenditure is up. But we also need to send work out to experts, because we can't include an expert in everything. And when we do, we choose the right expert, we go to whatever firm is necessary, regardless of who may be in politics or not in that firm. That is irrelevant to us. A man's expertise is a man's expertise, whatever his politics may be. But we spend it for the good of Gibraltar PLC, and we can show the results. And for every piece of work that we grief out, there is a piece of work that comes in. What we haven't done, Mr. Speaker, what we haven't done is pay a supporter of ours for very little demonstrable work, for any benefit whatsoever to Gibraltar PLC, a huge amount of money in order just to simply keep them industriously writing articles in our RAG that we fund to bring down the reputation of members of the group. As was the case, of course, when a certain Mr. Benson, a member of the executive committee, was paid approximately £250,000 in 1 year, without £250,000 of work to pay for, but lots of articles scribbled in a rag from number 6, denigrating everything that the then opposition used to do. £250,000 in legal fees. That's the sort of expenditure that we will not engage in. £250,000 down the drain, says the Minister for Justice, who has responsibilities for these matters. He should know. Look, Mr. Speaker, without a quarter of £1 million down the drain, we've got better usable cash reserves, less debt in growth and net spend, and we've got funding to show for the £1.4 million we spend on private sector legal fees, and we've got funding to show for our investment in the EUID. Every direction, bang up to date, and ECOFIN and closed loop approval. And then, because one of the things that he talks about is that the global leader of the mission is that we're not going to reach the 1.65 billion target. He's right, Mr. Speaker. We don't think we're going to reach the 1.65 billion target by the time of the next election. We think we're going to exceed it. We're going to go beyond the 1.65 billion target. But if we just reach it, again, in the same way as he talked about the commitments not being deliverable, what are we going to say if he is still the leader of the opposition in the budget debate before the general election, if the numbers are reflected in the book? It could be wastefully embarrassing for him if it does reflect the 1.65 billion GDP. I think the problem is that they just can't come to terms with it. They can't come to terms with the fact that the public finances are in such a parlous state. They can't come to terms with the fact that we are on target. They had to deliver the speeches that they've written probably over the weekend before they heard what I had to say. And of course, having spent 3 active weeks making these arguments in a by-election campaign, Monday was the proverbial agua fría, a jug of cold water. I could almost hear, amplified, what it was that they were whispering to each other. It sounded like a lot of campaign. It almost ruined our campaign. Give us a bit of idea. Just give the speeches that we were going to give. At least there'll be reported in the papers, and some people might miss what he said about this being the best, most brilliant budget in the history of Gibraltar. Because, well, otherwise, what would they do? And the entire thing to me, well, where are the European investors that you said were coming? And I don't try to think of them. They're very advanced in their investment, and when their investments are finalized, they will make an announcement. I mean, he said it so cynically as to suggest that they weren't there when I made the statement. The statement I'm going to tell him, as I told before, all he does is ensure that I take huge pleasure, perhaps more than one should be entitled to, when I do make the announcement that I know is coming about these investors. And of course, they have nothing to do with the funding. That is true. I don't know if you think of anyone in this business of the savings fund in their leaflet, in their think leaflet. Talk about something coming back to bite you in the political posterior. That think leaflet may come back to bite them very hard indeed. This is why you talk about a savings bank, given the power state of international banking, expanding its services into international banks. Well, look at this. Why is now, as it was when we all put it in all our manifestos, at a time when the banking crisis was at its highest, or is it that he doesn't know that in December 2011, things economically were far worse than they are now? But what he's trying to do, because, I mean, even when he is being attempting to be politically clever, the Honourable Gentleman is so transparent that he is like a white sheep. What he's trying to do is suggest that somehow the government is responsible for the Barclays abuse, that government is the problem, and that's why Barclays is leaving. If that is the game that he is trying to play, which nobody would for one moment believe to be true or knew anything about the issue, and doesn't he know, Mr. Speaker, because everybody else does, that one of the biggest issues that Barclays have had, once it needs to be working in financial services, to know what the issue is, one of the biggest issues is the huge impairment on loans granted by Barclays and their affordable housing schemes, which the previous chief minister said he was going to make birthday payments, and they, on the 7th of December, resiled from. Do you know that? But the other thing about friendship, can tell them that. And yet, I'm almost sure that he doesn't want the GOP to disappear. So he must be telling them all this. And in the same way that they don't listen to me, they must not be listening to him. Because otherwise they wouldn't be opening themselves up or resisting. I'm talking about the savings bank as he did. Look, the ones who remove the solvency ratio requirement in the savings bank is them. Didn't you hear that part of my speech where I told him that we were keeping in the savings bank the surpluses of the savings bank? Wouldn't require a piece of legislation to tell us to do it. We decided to do it, and we've done it for the second year running. Without it being a legal requirement. And in any event, when we talked about the amendment that I made to that savings bank, what he didn't say in the course of his remarks about it, probably the flattest part of what he said, I must say, the critique he was in, is that everything he said about investment ignored the fact that the person who's making the investment decision is exactly the same person who was making them before, the financial secretary, with the same appetite for risk as he had the day before the election. Didn't think that was worthy of a mention. All he wanted to do, Mr. Speaker, was raise perspectives that are not there. Try and make people think that there is an issue, but there isn't one. I think that has a name. It has a first name and a second name. It's called scaremongering. So, I think that that maiden speech was more of a damp squib than it was a legal opposition's reaction to a budget speech. It's dealt with now in everything I've said. But I do think that he does have a problem. And you know, there are, I hear already, quite quickly within 48 hours, that there are members of his executive committee who are very concerned indeed and regretting their decision in that now infamous in the annals of Gibraltar political history, that infamous secret ballot that delivered him the chair of leader of the party. In fact, Mr. Speaker, I think it's not lost on many of us that a lot of things have changed in the GOP since he took over. He's already said that the decision of the Honourable Backbencher and the handling by the Honourable Backbencher of the Theatre Royal issue was not appropriate. He's already distanced the party from that. Taken on the chin in an interview in BBC, he came over here from Mankara, and therefore nobody should have the opportunity of rubbing this in my face again. So already, he decried him once on that. We've seen, of course, that his position on the fishing dispute in 2003 was different to what Sir Peter's was in 1999, so he didn't really kind of find an angle on that. And after today, I guess so, that he'd be even distancing himself from all of the people's remarks on public finances. I mean, it's not been 5 months with Sir Peter, and over the leader of the opposition has denied Sir Peter more times than Peter denied Christ. What a palaver. And it's also not lost on anyone, I think, Mr. Speaker, the remarks that we've made in recognising Her Majesty's recognition of the Honourable Backbencher's service have almost been more fulsome from this side of the House than they have been from his side of the House. I think it was a better attempt to try and get at some of my supporters. Perhaps it's part of that wider plan. Perhaps he's made that not so transparent after all. Perhaps this is all coming buried even deeper and doing completely away with the political life of the Honourable the Backbencher. Not just getting rid of him as Chief Minister. Maybe you didn't understand him when he said those words yet. Maybe it's about getting rid of him from Gibraltar's political life completely. Maybe, Mr. Speaker, it's going to be a bit like the issue with Lenin and Trotsky. Perhaps when we look now at pictures of the GSD taken last year, the people may not be there. They have been cut out, as was done in the early part of the last century by Lenin to his ex-friend Trotsky. Even things like the deselection of candidates at the time of the general election in the GSD, the deselection of the honourable and popular Mr. Vinette, has his fingerprints all over it. The way that they're starting to shift party policy, even, Mr. Speaker, the permission granted for Mr. Vinette to make the statement that he made on the floor. I don't think I've ever seen the Honourable Backbencher as a red in the face, as when he turned up here and found out that the Honourable new leader of the opposition had allowed that to happen. I've seen him quite red because I don't think that upset him. And I must be seen by people today as a complete and utter pussycat compared to what the Twice were like in the 16 years that he was here. And I trust that I'm not red. I did take the blood pressure tablet this morning. But I've never seen Sir Peter so red as when he found out what had been allowed to go on here by the new leader of the GSD. So the collective change in half of the party to the pro-equality approach on civil partnerships, with global lady urging us on the civil partnerships legislation, whereas Mr. Bosina tried to pull the rein. I think that that's a very good thing. I must say that is a very good thing. Because it demonstrates that our winning the general election did not just trounce Mr. Cavana, it trounced the arguments that the GSD were putting for so many years that were wrong. So I salute the fact that he's repositioning his party and accepting all the things that were wrong. But then, of course, the reality would be that the GSD is no more. That GSD which stood for something is no more. I'd like to think the left here, because that would be nice that everybody here worked here. But you know, I think it's exactly what I said last year it would be. I told him I thought that this is what he would do, and he has not let me down. It's a left to the left on equality, but a left to the right on public sector spending. Exactly what I thought it would be. Left, right, exactly when it's in his interest. Perhaps he is as transparent as I thought he was. But no big secret, though. The Honourable Gentleman has made no secret of it. Because he told us on GBC in an interview, when they held their first ever annual general meeting, well, I don't think you can call it annual general meeting, unless you hold one every single year. But there has been such a broad church that includes people from the right, people from the centre, and people from the left. So, Mr. Speaker, look, that sounds like a party. But it doesn't sound like a political party. It sounds like a party I'd quite like to go to, where I exchange opinions with different people and have a drink. But if it's a political party, it's a party of opportunity, it's not a party of ideology. Because you can't have people of the right, the centre, and the left describe themselves as a political party with an ideology, having an ideology to stand for whatever may be best at a particular time in their view and in electoral sense. So, when you're analysing that way, Mr. Speaker, I suppose that this new mantra of Bianco, which is the Honourable Gentleman's new slogan, I'm surprised that he's decided to use a Spanish word as a slogan for his political party in Gibraltar. It's more like un pasito para adelante, dos pasitos para atrás. I almost expect to see him not singing Tom Jones, but dancing Maria. Un pasito para adelante, dos pasitos para atrás. And I've got to wonder, why is it that the honourable the backbencher has inflicted this on his party? You see, the honourable the backbencher was very honest in his political views. Very honest. Some years ago, he told the Civil Assembly in the course of this debate, at this part of the debate, that he, the Civil Assembly, may he rest in peace, was too good for politics. And what was needed in politics to succeed was malaria. He used a Spanish word, bad note. But a bad note is a bit too literal. So, guile and bad ideas, I suppose. So when we look at honourable members of the today and we see what they've said in the context of this second reading, we see how they've opened themselves up in this campaign to have themselves completely shut down by the evidence that I gave at the beginning of this reply. Given what the others have said and the repositioning that they've done, I can see exactly where the GSP is today. The GSP today, is all of the malaria of the GSP before and none of the brains. That's the new GSP. All of the malaria and none of the brains. Very well repositioned. Well, let me move from there, Mr. Speaker, to the brains in the outfit, and to a much more lucid and equally disagreeable intervention of the Honourable the Backbencher, who told us that he wouldn't be here during the course of the debate because he has other matters on. So he will excuse me that I continue to make my reply to him. I'm sure that he will have an opportunity to read it, but I of course accept and have other responsibilities now. And having been here for 20 odd debates in the past, I absolutely understand that he's not just there. His contribution was disagreeable because of the things he said about public finances, which I have now dealt with. But it was, to an extent, much more convivial than the others. Because although, of course, he said that a lot of work had been done on repositioning, okay, the deficit in years, we can't pretend to have done the income tax act, which was drafted when they were here, and supported a lot of that work from opposition. He was wrong to say that I had criticized him for notifying the new tax act to the country. I hadn't criticized him for that. What I did criticize him for was for the opposite, for not notifying the income tax act for state aid clearance, something which, as honourable members know, is now something we are having to deal with. And he said, and he was right, Mr. Speaker, that the culture of compliance that we have ushered in enables us not just to seek and demand fair treatment from the international community, it enables us to seek and demand fair treatment from the United Kingdom on matters where the United Kingdom can assist us in taking us off blacklist and other such issues. And I think he was right that he made the intervention that he made in the term that he made it. Because in doing so, he disclosed some affinity with the government's position, contrary to some of the things we heard from other members. But he did during the course of the parliamentary reform debate, where it will not have been lost on anyone, much less members on the opposite benches, that there were parts of the debate on parliamentary reform where the Honourable Mr. Peter Kahana agreed with the government and not with the opposition. And this is true of his intervention also on the Sanborn Hotel, where he said, look, I understand the thinking there, and it may be the honourable members are right, but I reserve judgment as to location and other issues. If this has put other hotels off, that's a bad thing. And I'm quite happy to tell them, it hasn't put other hotels off. The people they were negotiating with were still negotiating with, but there were no commitments tied up before the election, as has been pretended. And even in the savings bank, although we disagree on the details, he was confirming his view that there should be some government involvement in major bills of aid. He at least is not decrying that part of the manifesto that is not yet 18 months old. But of course, Mr. Speaker, the one thing that is clear is that to an extent I'm helping the Honourable Leader of the do the job that he wants to do, the publication of these memoranda of the 8th of December and the Doomsday memoranda of the 13th of December is the final nail in the political coffin of Sir Peter Brown, because it demonstrates the state of public finances on the last day that he was Chief Minister, beyond peradventure. And I want to thank him, Mr. Speaker, because in the course of the parliamentary reform debate, he was honest to a fault in recognizing the work that we had done in 18 months, led by the Deputy Chief Minister principally, and by me as Leader of the House, of course, in calling the meeting, in order to usher in a new parliamentary era for our country. He said, as I sometimes wish they would, because it would make the political argument easier, we could have done it at any time in the past 16 years, and we did not, because it obviously was not as much of a priority for us as it has been for them. They demonstrated that they have done what they set out to do immediately that they were elected, and I want to recognize that. We want to agree with some things that we said and disagree with others, but that is an honest approach to taking a debate. If you see, Mr. Speaker, when they, who are what's left of the GSD on the front bench, this week with all the malaria and none of the brain of the previous GSD, accuse us of not being transparent or democratic in our approach, they really do appeal only to their blindest sycophants. Because we call 10 meetings of this parliament a year. This year we're going to call 9 because, by agreement, we didn't call 1 in order to allow the refurbishment. Even if we didn't answer any questions, and we answered them all, even though they might not like the answer, we answer every single question. Even if we didn't answer any questions, they have 10 opportunities a year to embarrass us because we don't answer a question. And therefore, of course, we do answer questions and we give information. Because unless they think that we are completely stupid, if you don't want to answer questions, you don't call a meeting of the House. There's a constitutional obligation to call 3 in a year when there is an election. And I call 10. So it's not that we've got to understand that politics should mean something to people. There has to be a basis in reality. The Honourable Deputy Minister and I have been at this game for 21 years. The Honourable Mohsan has been at this game for 40 years, 41 coming up at the end of July. You can't make it up. What you say has to be real and relevant. Because if you make it up, people know that you make it up. People are wiser than politicians when it comes to working out who's telling the truth and who's not. That's why with these documents, the arguments are going to be settled for them on public finance. And that's why on democracy and on transparency, when people see that we come here every month and we answer every question, they have no stuck with arguments that we don't. Democracy is not just about parliament. It's about other instruments and the Development and Planning Commission being held in the open now demonstrates that commitment to transparency and accountability. And these numbers, set out as clearly as they are, demonstrate a commitment to transparency and accountability. But they need to analyze them. They can't just ignore them. I think the Honourable Gentleman and I will at least agree on one thing. there was a candidate last night at one of the chamber, or at the chamber dinner, who said that there was no transparency in Gibraltar and politicians just saying what they like. But we can argue about many things, but he and I will agree, no doubt, that politicians in Gibraltar need to account for every penny that they spend. How do we do that? And at the DPC, every permission that is granted is now open to scrutiny. They just need to turn up. So it's clear to any objective observer, not that there are any on the other side, that there is more openness and transparency than there has ever been before. And I want to therefore thank the Honourable Backbencher for having made the point himself during his speech on the parliamentary reform motion. But I think what worried me the most, Mr. Speaker, about the intervention of Sir Peter Caruana, what really concerned me was something that started during the course of their annual general meeting. He said during the course of their AGM, which was shown on television, this one that this meeting that cannot be described as annual because it doesn't happen every year. I think for them, the A means whole general meeting. It is a third one that they like, not necessarily annually. That's what their AGM stands for. And he said during the course of that meeting that he thought that foreign policy being conducted from number 6 to number 8 was almost his foreign policy. He said, if one of the guys are doing it, every time he picks up a problem, it's like the one is doing it. Well, I think that's it. But I know a kiss of death when I see one. So I'm not going to quickly cross my lips to him to avoid that. Because my foreign policy is very different to the foreign policy that people do. But during the parliamentary reform debate, he said that he agreed with that. At the AGM, he said that the foreign policy was very similar to his, or the leader of the opposition there suggests that it's not. And then, on the Monday morning, the last thing I needed to hear was the Honourable Peter Caruana say, and his budget speeches sound like mine too. I think if you're so let down by the new leader of the GOP, then he wishes it was me. But I really see a kiss of death when I know a kiss of death when I see it coming. I think it's just an attempt to denigrate me in front of my own supporters. But let me turn to somebody else who might, given the flux that there is on the other side, might yet become leader of the new GSD, which I described a moment ago. Let me turn to Mr. Neville's contribution. I saw the text being passed of that contribution back and forth between him and Mr. Peter, with huge amounts of red ink on it from Mr. Peter's red hyperactive pen. Well, I don't know whether this particular remark was Mr. Neville's own work or Mr. Peter's work, but he said, that a sound environment is as important as a sound economy. But it makes sense that John Conteste would agree with that. And every member on this side would agree with that, Mr. Speaker. Because every minister in this government is a minister for the environment. But how can it be said by anybody on that side of the House? Don't they realize that they went on election defending a diesel power station as the only solution to our power generation needs for the next 30 years? Well, I was delighted to hear John Conteste remind us that in the new Gibraltar, with the vote of the new dawn, the environment really matters. And when there is action on renewable energy, despite their inaction in the past 15 years, it won't be because the honourable gentleman asked the question, and well, I now hope that because when I've asked the question, there is going to be some movement on renewable energy. Excuse me, I can't quite do the monotone. There will be action on renewable energy because there's been action from the day we were elected. Action to question. And the environmental filter that they now refer to, they refer to it as if it were a normal thing. Thank goodness, Mr. Speaker, because that suddenly states the change that we've ushered in. That everything should go through an environmental filter, and that filter is the 10 ministers, not one. That filter is working. And there's no question of any minister putting John Curtis under pressure to accept anything and surrender an environmental point of concern. We've got a minister for the environment who was Mr. Environment before the election. And we're all ministers with responsibility to care for our environment. We don't put pressure on each other. That's not how this government works. It may be how they are used to working in government, or even in opposition. But look, it really betrays a very interesting point of how does that Mr. Wetter appears to have got used to being treated by his colleagues. I suppose there's that bad myth rearing its head again. I mean, the thought of putting one person under pressure to surrender an environmental point, I think I'd find him chained to the cabinet table rather than the nearest tree. But Mr. Wetter need not worry. We are not going to put him under pressure to do anything. Although he may find that there's pressure coming from another angle that he might not expect it from. The very unhelpful thing that he said, Mr. Speaker, was that it's disgraceful that we haven't yet, I'm paraphrasing, we haven't yet published some reports, or that we took so long to publish the fishing report. That's something that Mrs. Hammond herself says in the course of her intervention. It's disgraceful that things are wrong. Maybe it's been formative. Ha ha! Cynical remark. Perhaps it's been formative that they've spoken so long. Well, look, Mr. Speaker, it's ill behaving to chastise us because we are working on reports and we haven't yet published them. Because they should know, or perhaps you know, that their collective memory has disappeared when most of the members who were in government have gone and the Honourable Backbencher has disengaged. It ill behaves them to surprise us for not publishing reports within a few days of receiving them when they never publish reports. They kept them secret. The King report into GBC was published by this government within weeks of being elected. The report into Customs has been given to members of Customs at last and ready for publication. Reports that they use taxpayers' money to procure, which they never publish. So how can we now be attacked because we take a few months to publish something? It's nonsensical. This is the politics of the world started on the 9th of December 2011. I'm prepared to accept that politics from them. If they accept that the 9th of December was a new dawn where Gibraltar emerged from the darkness of 60 years of non-publication of reports to a day in which reports are published as soon as possible. But they really do open the flank for me to remind them that they're saying things about us not publishing a report within 10 minutes, and the King report took 5 years to be published, was published when I was elected. And then, of course, the incredible interplay between the remarks from Mr. Figueroa and the remarks from Mr. Medley. Figueroa saying, go back to the old style GPC. Don't subject yourself to it. Just rule, govern, decide, and do. And the whole campaign of this, the Prime Minister done deal, well, actually, you know, if Figueroa were the Minister for Planning, the Honourable Mr. Figueroa were the Minister for Planning, everything would be a done deal, wouldn't it? And it wouldn't be done in the open. So, fascinating and right, by the way, but I'm afraid to say that absolutely right, that he should come here and make remarks about what he heard in the GPC. That is why the GPC is open, so he can talk turn up there, he can listen, he can bring here, to the heart of our community, democracy, anything that he has said there, because we open that up and we come here once a month to hear what he has to say. The remarks he made were nonsensical, but he's entitled to make them. I'm on the mechanic, Mr. Speaker. Look, Mr. Edward. Mr. Edward needs to, Mr. Edward doesn't need to even know the coffee, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Edward just needs to wake up. Look, that he thinks he's carrying a brief for. When you insist that we should be killing monkeys in Gibraltar. Do you realize that we are one chromosome away from being human beings? And some things are bad, not even one chromosome. Because I think I'm very clever monkey. Do you realize that the apes are our Mickey Mouse, our biggest draw? Nobody comes to Gibraltar to see him. Only, for that matter, they come to see the apes, and they come to see the rock. And he's saying that the management plan, as far as he's concerned, could still be to put a bullet between their eyes. Come on. And one bent tire, Mr. Speaker, of the debate on environmental issues in this house. One does come. Because committed though we are to the subject, and without the need for the other members to raise any issues, we are committed to it entirely. Yes. It started off called first versus together. It then became, in terms of standard portfolios, called death versus nothing. So let me see that. Pro versus amateur. Pro versus amateur. It just doesn't take the debate any further. It's a one-sided debate. The only doctor that does knows what he's talking about. And that's why when the Honourable the backbencher, when he was leader of the House in the few minutes ago, thought he was insulting the Honourable Dr. Vettel by calling him a hazelnut, a gardener, an attempt to somehow denigrate him in the eyes of the many before the general election campaign. What he was doing, actually, was giving Dr. Vettel the badge of honour, of recognition by all our community as the excellent botanist that he also is. But in terms of the political history of Gibraltar, a subject that unfortunately I'm going to come back to in a few minutes when I start dealing with what I require to be called the intervention by Mr. Fiona. It's also important for Mr. Neville to get his political history right. The first Minister for the Environment in the history of Gibraltar was appointed by the GSLP in 1988. Yes, it is. It's a fact. Can't argue it. Can't get up in this house and say the First Minister for the Environment is appointed by the GOP. It's not true. The other government is responsible for raising up in this place. And in the Chronicle, and in the Panorama, and on BBC. And if he wants to have a genuine debate, he should have it on the fact. And then he says, you don't give us the minutes of the Nature Conservancy Council, a council which I never called meetings of when I was Minister for the Environment. So the legal advice that we have, I'm happy to tell them, is that we have no obligation to publish them. And you don't monitor black carbon and radon. Actually, we do. It's one of the many things that Mr. Cortez is not, Dr. Cortez is not able to talk about in the course of his budget speech, because otherwise, if he took us through the list of things that we've done, which are positive for the environment, since the 8th of December, we'd still be listening to him. Measurement of black carbon is already taking place, and we're going to be among the first EU countries to monitor this pollution. That's off, Dr. Cortez, and all your things. Data on radium levels has already been collected, Mr. Speaker. It's analyzed by the Environment Agency with the Department of the Environment, and the studies will be, and the results will be published shortly. And of course, Mr. Wilson didn't like solutions. He was, there is no an age management plan. But he didn't want to talk about that. He wanted to talk about Karen. But he was obviously a small constituency about that supports Karen. And he's trying his best to have that constituency on his side. I think maybe it's the Stephen Club. We've got nothing else that moves the Stephen. I'm going to move right now, Mr. Speaker, to the intervention by the Honourable Mr. Hayward, who, if you will allow me, by my say so, was a little bit more constructive in his approach, and I want to recognise that. I'm happy to tell him that I'm working very closely indeed with Unite, Mr. Speaker, on the subject of the Housing Works Agency and the manning level service. But I do think that his concern about the manning level has to be set in context. He knows, doesn't he, that it was the government of which he was a member that did an agreement of two out for one in the Housing Works Agency. Because it was an agreement signed by his previous leader. So your concern about reduction in manning levels has to be seen in that context. So nobody who thinks the agreement was a good thing or a bad thing. He talked about the agreement and his tone in respect to the agreement seems to be positive. But then he turned to the manning level and seemed to ignore this clause 42, I think it was, of the agreement. And now it appears that he also agrees with our policy, Mr. Speaker, of moving the housing department out of the Norway. Look, thank you for what appears to be tacit approval of that and support for it. It is happening, it's something that will happen. It's an untimed commitment in our manifesto. It will happen before the time of the next general election. But then he wanted to talk about the co-ownership scheme. And he gave us a remark in his speech, which, in my view, turned everything slightly more cynical. He talked about, oh, you paid these consultancy fees and the book hasn't been low. And then he said, don't make the mistakes that were made before in co-ownership. Well, that's why you pay consultants before you lay a book. But anyway, I would have thought that they know that, given how much they spend on consulting. Well done for eventually listening to the tenants of the housing estate and not adding the floor. I'm going to take those 2 points together. We didn't eventually listen to the people in the housing estate. We listened to the DPC and we went to the housing. I personally went to every one of the housing estates involved and spoke to the tenants. So we didn't eventually listen to them. We set out a consultation and listened to them. But the cynical backhander, I cannot allow him to get away with. He said the construction problems in the co-ownership schemes under the GSLP. This is the party that doesn't want us to look back, but only wants us to look forward. I guess that's why Falange as well, Mr. Chairman, because Mr. Speaker, because they have such problems with what came at last that they only want us to look Falange. They only want us to look forward, not back. And yet, even in 2013, when dealing with co-ownership, honourable members still quite relaxed about going back to 1996. But they don't need to be decision. Because problems with co-ownership construction, there have been in everything that has been constructed, even waterfront territory, which admittedly has the least of the problems, but has problems. Even in some parts of the Mid Harbour estate, where there are considerable problems, and particularly in the OEM co-ownership estate. The other member wants to talk about problems in the construction of co-ownership estates. So we need to go back to 1996. And I quite wanted to tell him that for this government, to sort out the mess that they left behind is going to cost about £10 million. And the difference, Mr. Speaker, between the bills that we have and the bills for repairing Harbor View is very simple. And I'm going to remove the moment that he said this backhanded remark, because it's going to allow me to put in the public domain today that it's going to cost us £10 million to fix the coronavirus estate that they left behind. And we will not be able to sue a developer or a construction company to get the money back, as they did and we would have done in respect of the Harbour View fiasco, as they call it, where the money was paid back by the contractor and developer who had been responsible for the mistake. Because of the collapse of Haymill and OEM, there's no one to sue, because the work was finished by DJBS, which is the government's own company, which inherited the mess, and did its best to complete the work, and by doing that, its best to fix the problem. So their $10 million of cost of repair will have to come out of the pocket of the taxpayers of Gibraltar. They'll pay over to Gibraltar. That's what they thought was the easy play of referring back to Harbour View, is something that was paid for by the people who caused the problem. And I acknowledge that he encouraged us to get on with the refurbishment of the estate that they had completely forgotten. We did nothing about it 16 years. To such an extent, that campaigning for the GSD with Morris Castle was not a fun thing to be involved in. And yet now they urge us to move quickly. Look, I suppose that's part of the repositioning of the GSD. So what you have to say, don't worry about the consequences. Big Elder will slam us because it is completely ridiculous for us to be saying this when we did nothing about it. But over my own, none of the brains. Keep it up, those of you. Now, let me turn to the intervention by the Honourable Lady Speaker. I found it amusing, to say the least, that she said that a lot of what was happening in respect of the portfolios that she was carrying was that there was a lack of fatal opportunities and not enough work. Because the other lady ends her intervention by saying that some people are petty, one thing and the other. Again, but she starts by saying, oh, the ministers are taking both photographs and they are doing work. Anybody who knows any minister on this side, anybody who wants to look, knows how many hours all ministers are working, each of them in charge of their portfolio. But the Honourable Lady should know, and if people don't tell her, look, it's my obligation to tell her here. But she's known throughout the community now as somebody who jumps into the shop as soon as somebody takes out a camera. I almost dare say it's what the leader of the opposition has told her to do. Isn't it? Make sure you're at everything and that you get into every shop. And I'm fine with that. If you want to show your community that she's at events, that's absolutely fine. But don't attack ministers for being in photographs when they are doing the work that they are paid to do. And she doesn't need to do that with respect. Dexterity. But I'm sure that she is in the photograph albums of more than one Gibraltar tourist who has been mistaken for a journalist as they were taking a shot of some particular part of our geography that they particularly like. You may know, she may have a fan club in Japan. But this is the tenor of the remark that she was making in the context of a serious debate on estimates. I mean, I don't think I've ever been in a debate on the appropriation bill where less attention was paid to the appropriation. How is it different? This is a, what can I say to embarrass the government? What can I say that sounds good? What can I put in the newspapers tomorrow? The numbers are just completely ignored. And this is what we're saying, it's remarkable that we've now got somebody at the DHA who's going to be CEO and who's permanent and pensionable, and that shouldn't be the case. So everybody who has remarked to me about the choice of CEO for the Broken Heart Authority, a person who I do not know, has told me that they believe this is an excellent choice made by the relevant board. But he's taking a technical point, namely that he should not be a permanent and pensionable member of the establishment. Now, this is completely unacceptable. And this is part of the loss of the collective gain of the GOP, because while they were in government, the CEO of the care agency, or the elderly care agency, whatever it was called then, is a PMP civil servant. How can she make the point and not seem nonsensical? I mean, it's just as nonsensical and nothing in depth. I need to come back to this point about people obviously not knowing the political history of Gibraltar. As the point we made last year, that at last, you weren't here, Mr. Speaker, it's important for you to know. Last year, she said, at last, there are women on both sides of the House. For the first time in history. It's a simple fact of point, Mr. Speaker. Miss Marie Mandelito was in the House when we had a convention at the same time as Mrs. Zelaya. We can't get that right, Mr. Speaker. I suppose you can't be expected to do an in-depth analysis of the numbers. And it's just like, I mean, I often say that members' mouths on the other side engage before their brains. But in her case, Mr. Speaker, sometimes it's her fingers engaging before her brain when she tweets things. What are they doing to come to embarrass the people when some work started there at the end of May? What are they doing to our beach? People know what we were doing for the beach, Mr. Speaker. We're making it accessible at last. It would be even more accessible when the book left to get people to the shore arrived, which haven't arrived. But well done, Minister Costa. Well done, Minister Sacramento. Well done, Minister Linares, for delivering at last an accessible beach there and elsewhere in Gibraltar. I suppose that the answer to what are they doing to our beaches, what are they doing to Catherine Bay, is now writ so large, it's such the right thing to do that she must really be disappointed with herself for engaging fingers and thumbs before brain. But this criticism, Mr. Speaker, that she makes of the percentage of women on board, but I know that she doesn't like to talk about the board of GBC. I think she's actually said to people, don't mention the GBC board, because there are more women on the board of GBC than there have ever been. I think it's actually 40 or 50% of the board of GBC is women. But not that that matters, because what matters is who's right for the job. Not a percentage of people. That's not equality. That's the sort of number crunching we should be doing about the estimate. I mean, issues relating to Moroccan nationalists. Don't you hear the bit that I spoke about in terms of the number of people who've been naturalized? Just ignore that. I suppose that's just another one of the parts of the speech that was written that had to be delivered. And we talk about 52 breakdowns of ambulances. If you've got it to check, 37 of those relate to the ambulances that we inherited from them and have had to repair. And then what looks at first blush as a huge and justified criticism. The THA should not be called to start the party political exchanges with the opposition and denigrate opposition members. That sounds good. That's the kind of good if you're typing it or writing it. But of course, it ignores an important part of the political history of Gibraltar as well, which is that for the 16 years that they were in power, oral engagement in respect of health matters was done by the GHO and the letterhead of the GHO. And there are some pretty tough ones. I sat in Mr. Foster, who was then a young man, new into Parliament, the blue-eyed boy of the opposition benches being fired on the letterhead of the GHO. What's worse, Mr. Speaker? The CEO of the GHO was rolled out to do party politics for the members of it when they were in government. Not that he got very far, because you know, most of the Mr. Costa's credibility, his was absolutely on the floor. But I guess if you're saying that, it's another one of those things where the GSC is being repositioned. The old GSC did one thing, the new GSC does another. There's nothing of substance. It's got something to say, oh, I didn't vote GSC before because they were in favour of the GHA answering questions. Now that they're not going to allow the GHA to answer questions, then they will themselves answer the vote GSC. It's not a repositioning of any substance, Mr. Speaker. It's a little bit irrelevant. I want to criticise you, Mr. Speaker, the board of the GHA, of which he was a member, for not being open enough. He was a member before the election. Now it's completely open. People can turn up and listen to what was going on. When he was a member of the board, he didn't say, hey, Chuck, let's open up. But now to criticise is that there isn't enough openness. Doesn't he realise that people can now put things on the agenda of the GHA board for discussion before it orders to be done through the minister or the CEO? And what's going on? Shouldn't you at least give the chief executive a chance to do his probationary year? Then he talks about John Lennon and criticizes him for the work that he did. Well, I mean, I think everybody who knows John Lennon and who knows what's going on in the GHA is very much welcome what he did, and the fact that he and he in particular has been working for much less pay than the former chief executive, Dr. McCutcheon. Ably assisted by Mr. Lima, I must say. Very ably assisted by Mr. Lima. And also criticizes the increase in the budget of the GHA, but says that the GHA must do more. So let's be clear, if they were to get an election tomorrow, they would cut the budget of the GHA again. The GHA is coming on budget well down the road for the first time in history, and it will come back but it will end up more services. This is the twilight zone world in which members of it live. And the spending on locums, he says, is an issue. But it's down from 3.5 million in 2010-11, when they were in power, to 1.9 million when they were in power for 2/3 of the year, to 1.58 million when we've been in power for the whole of the financial year. So that analysis is just completely incorrect. And in social services, he says, I reviewed the press releases and not much is happening. But if you think that work is reflected in press releases, they say that only too many press releases. And then when they do a review of a department, when they have a reshuffle, all they do is look at the press releases. And if they have enough press releases, you haven't done enough. But they've got to make up their minds. Do they want to see your press release every day saying what we've done? There's much more going on than press releases in the social services agency. The whole list of things that the Honourable Member, Mr. Valenza, set out. We haven't continued the GSC approach to training. We've changed it and improved it considerably. Generic core training is enhanced. 65 sessions delivered last year. Staff development training is a new thing, involving the staff and how to train core training. Sharing training with the DHA, because this is one government, as my ministers constantly remind them. Social workers go to the UK for training, some of them have been suspended for many years. And the big, big change, domiciliary care. Yes, they offered some, but that's where the similarity ends. No one used to get domiciliary care before when they needed it. They used to go to the waiting list. And so somebody who was getting it died and then they would get their full return. Now there are two providers instead of one. The budget is increased to £550,000, and we get a better deal, so we get more domicile repair. There is no historic waiting list for domicile repair now. Did you hear me? There is no historic waiting list for domicile repair now. That's over, finished, as a result of the sterling work done by Samantha Sacramento after the 9th of December. A huge improvement. There's the current waiting list, but there is the historic waiting list. Assessments of significant waiting list are done by people who know, by social workers, not by clerks. And this is just the changes. I mean, the Kuiper Ward is what we've done in the 18 months. So we did the Kuiper Ward in 4 months. 3, in fact. And we still haven't been able to stop cancellation of operations. There were no cancellation of operations due to bed shortages, of almost zero, from most of 2012. And in early 2013, they were due to the annual winter surge. But especially happy, there's been an increase in social work as well, at least here, and pleased to share some happiness. And the clubhouse says that the separation is not the right place for them, well, you gave it to them. The temporary place is even better than the final place that they would have. I think the most pathetic of the arguments put, this welcoming of the care agency parity with GHA for the grades that used to have the analogue. Don't you know that this is a problem that they created in 2009? Don't you know that they kept people waiting until the election 2011 and still haven't sorted out? How can you make that a point that you say to welcome when her party, when it was in government, didn't deal with it? I mean, this is just repositioning of the GOP, but repositioning using only malaise and no brain. I want to turn now, Mr. Speaker, to a man I will consider a friend. I continue to consider a friend, and evidence of the fact that politics doesn't need to get in the way of friendship. So, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Bakuna obviously started his intervention devastated by the fact that the employment survey publication on Friday had really done for their argument on the future job strategy, and still looking at the wound of the loss of the leadership of the party in February. I guess that's why most of his intervention was given to Britain's peace. Because of the problem with the numbers and the employment survey and the fact that he wasn't sitting closer to the centre of the service system. But, you know, I have to recognise that the Honourable Leader of the Opposition, the Honourable Leader of the Opposition has done an interesting political job on him by giving him this poison chalice of having to shadow the great Labour family. It is a poison chalice. Not just because Joe Bolsonaro is going to do what he says he's going to do in politics on every occasion, in every portfolio, but obviously, for him in particular, because his new beloved leader has made him shadow his former beloved leader and idol. And actually, I mean, hats off to the leader of the leader. That is why the political move there. Well, obviously the first strategy in the by-election was rubbish with other strategy. Employment survey is published. OGD, what do we do now? Because you see, on Friday of last week, Gibraltar saw for the first time the huge success that Joe Bolsonaro has brought to the employment ministry. 524 jobs for Gibraltarians in 1 year, compared to the average growth of 22 Gibraltarian jobs in 1 year under the GSD for 16 years. And the unemployment at 522 reduced from the 1,000 of the honorable leader of the opposition, was thrilled by a Freudian slip of the tongue during the course of the general election campaign, must be the unemployment, given the calculation that he did as to the cost of the future job strategy as he understood it to be. So, Mr. Martinez is wrong-footed at the general election because he's going for party that reason. He's wrong-footed at the leadership election because he was not elected as a result of this nefarious secret ballot that snares him at the last minute. And then he's wrong-footed on the employment survey in the middle of the by-election campaign. My dear friend, Mr. Martinez's political career really seems to be going down in the doldrums. When I said that everything that was going up that should go up and everything that was going down that should go down, I didn't mean him. He knows I'm a fan of him. You see, I guess there's a lesson in that, though, for the honourable gentleman. He started the intervention by saying, by attacking, that's when he was attacking, because he used it as an attack. Joe Bassano is a leopard that doesn't change his spot. And he was wrong to attack Joe Bassano on that basis. That's Mr. Bassano's strength. It's not his weakness. He's always been making the same point in government as he was making as leader of the opposition and as a opposition member for 15 years. And as chief minister for 8 before then. He's sure of his position. He's sure of his ideology. And that's why he's seen it through into this massive success in the employment survey. And that's why he enjoys a massive respect among the population, even among people who don't vote for him. But the Honourable Mr. Messina keeps changing his spots at just the wrong time. That's the problem. He went from admiring Joe to joining the DNC Liberal Party to leaving us because we've merged with the DSOP in this alliance, this electoral alliance that we do, because Mr. Bassano remained leader, to then taking the final step to the dark side by joining the GSP, and then to arguing finally as we merge in the GSP to say that Joe Bassano is the danger to Gibraltar, the problem. So from idolatry to saying that Mr. Bassano is the danger. Look, I will allow Mr. Bassano to, of course, take his own counsel. I will always say this. And the first thing I would say to everybody on the other side, I will say it to him privately, I'll say it to him publicly now. It's a two-way road. You can come back. Because if you're going to change your spot again, change them at the right time. Otherwise, that political career is just going to keep going in the same direction. So, the Honourable Gentleman hasn't just changed his spot. He's not got spot anymore, he's got stripes. It's a complete transformation for Mr. Messina. And he quotes me when I was leader of the opposition, Mr. Speaker, talking about the figures and what I said about people who are unemployed. I was dealing with the public figures then, not with the real figure that Mr. Peterson disclosed during the general election campaign. I was talking about the 400 odd, when in fact the number was, we were told later, about 1,000. About people being fed up. There were over 420 people fed up, there were 1,000 people fed up. Half of those already, more than half, people were having dealt with. But some people were so fed up, they didn't even dare to turn up and sign on as an employee. Because all of those things to do was, if he turned up to the office, smoke his way through the day, or perhaps not turn up at the office and go down to a particular cafe in town to avoid being in the office. But now there's a middle step there, working for our unemployed, people are coming back and registering themselves. And if you look at how long people have been unemployed for, the Honourable Gentleman might find that some of the people who he's complaining are now on that list and the unemployment has gone up have been unemployed from the time when they were in power. So unemployment is down. And that's going to speak of him to them. So, what then? We are not going, we are not being transparent and democratic in the way that we approach our obligations to parliamentarians. As I told others before, people are never going to believe that. They're going to compare what you say about unemployment and what you say about democracy. Look at what Mr. Peter said during the election campaign about 1,000 unemployed. Look at the fact that you, that GOP called one meeting of the House in 2001 and 2002, a maximum of two before the election, and that we called 10, and that we cut unemployment by half, and that they said they were not a man to be believed. So my advice to him is, don't do that. Because the speech from which he quotes, I'm going to like to hear it. The speech from which he quotes me, that speech I gave is interview of the system. I don't like to blow my own trumpet, but the honorable Professor Benedict Nelson in this house, and I used to complain that he used to blow his own trumpet, he used to say to me, he said, if you don't blow your own trumpet, nobody will. So I'm going to just take a leaf out of his book for a moment, and I'm going to say to him, that speech that he quotes me from, that interview of the system speech, is undoubtedly, when you look at the facts, the most successful budget speech ever delivered by any leader of the opposition, because within months, I was occupying this chair, not that one. And the person who said the post, the leader of the opposition for the shortest period of time, although I don't know whether Mr. Peter is about to beat me the day after the by-election. So I understand why he didn't have a quote from this speech. But to extrapolate from that, this Bermuda Triangle that he talked about, but look, I think there is a Bermuda Triangle integration. And I'm trying to find it. Because in the Bermuda Triangle that he talks about, which doesn't contain any jobs, there must be £10 million for where the Theatre Royal used to be. And when I get my hands in it, I'll put it back into government coffers. There must be many millions more pounds that were wasted during the time that honourable members were in power. That's the Bermuda Triangle that is afflicted Gibraltar for the past 2 years. But is it a reasonable not to silence, Mr. Speaker? We will exercise our freedom of speech, Mr. Speaker. I give you all the government advice to make better points. I'm not saying you shouldn't make points. This government doesn't want to silence them. We, in fact, given the tenor of what they say, we're actually quite happy that they should continue to be the opposition and continue to make the arguments that they're making as loud as they can, because it is so easy to discredit them that we are guaranteed government whilst they continue to make these maladjusted no-brain points. So don't worry about us wanting to silence them. I positively encourage them to continue engaging mouth before brain as they have done in the course of this debate. And he replied to Mr. Costa only on one point. And one knows the point that the GSC are going to make in this case, Mr. Speaker, because one sees them tweeted a couple of days before, either by them or by some of their sycophantic supporters. Ah, call this progress. The number of proofs for 2012 was down. Helen Winston. Fingers engaged before brain by whoever tweeted that one. But I expect it better from him, because he engaged brain before mouth, or mouth before brain, when he repeated it. Doesn't he know that people are booked a year, sometimes 2 years in advance, and that the numbers for 2012 are the numbers which reflect the bookings when they were in government until December 2011? Doesn't he know that? Can you accept it? It's very simple, straightforward. Then you realize that what he's done is raise a criticism of the government whose record he's trying to defend. And I would like to have a meaningful debate. I too would like to have to engage them in order to reply to them. But it's just too easy. They give us the argument, on the one hand, that bookings are done 2 years in advance through the winter holiday, and then they give us the argument from the casino that the bookings for 2012 are down and this is awful. Join the two together and you have the answer. I'm almost bored in having to reply. I really expected so much more, Mr. Speaker. Class of 84 expects so much more, Mr. Speaker. This is scary, Mr. Speaker. I never say the word that you have been there last year. And each of the leaders of the opposition who want to be positive to the faithful can't make mistakes like that, because we'll be reminding you year after year, Mr. Speaker, in this place. The final thing I want to say to the Honourable Mr. Pacino is to ask him to consider an inverse proposition. As I say that, I mean the opposite of something he said, yeah? Even was so confident that the result of the by-election will be that their candidate will emerge as the winner, that is, if after today he doesn't decide that he's not their candidate anymore, he goes back to being an independent, which he was a couple of weeks ago. Because he's so confident that their candidate is going to win, because the government lost the election and should immediately call a general election. I bet that line sounded good when he wrote it. I would ask him a question, and he doesn't have to answer, because in this house, in this debate, he doesn't have to answer. But what happens if the opposite is? And their candidate does not emerge victorious in the by-election, if he is still their candidate by the date of the by-election? What happens if our candidate emerges victorious from the by-election? And I do not see any polls, good or bad. What the people will do, the people will do. They will decide. They will determine who fills Charles Wilson's seat in this parliament. But the inverse proposition of what he puts to me is that I should put to him that they should all resign on the day after the by-election if their candidate for him in, and ask the people for a mandate to renew them in opposition. We can quite happily do so without having to have a general election. We can have 7 new by-elections, and we have a new opposition, a PDP opposition, a Brian Vermitt, and 7 or 6 other independent party oppositions. Or they might be renewed, and Sir Peter may go, and Mullen may come in, or somebody else. But if he says to me, with such a good thing, if you lose the by-election, you must call a general election. Well, what happens if you lose the by-election? Why don't you put your feet where your mouth is? That's why it's important to also engage brain before pen. But Mr. Speaker, talking about resigning, perhaps it's something that Mr. Pineda may want to start considering immediately. Because if you think of frankly, in a stable of lackluster speeches, seems to be really lacking any meaningful analysis. All it had was partisan bent. Some of the other threats, particularly in the opposition, that that was true. But Mr. Philosopher was absolutely different. And when you utter this first sentence, you got it right. This first sentence, yesterday, he said, and the Minister of Federal Government for Justice and Home Affairs. I don't know whether that means that he's in charge of the cooking at home, Mr. Speaker, but there is no portfolio of home affairs in Gibraltar. There is a Minister for Justice, and he travels the Minister for Justice. And so I don't know what Mr. Nguni's arrangements at home are. And even though he described himself, Mr. Speaker, there's no Minister for Justice in home affairs. So he couldn't even get the name of his travel responsibilities there. But what did he say? He went on to talk about how we should not enable reforms to the DPC. Well, I know this is very old, because he said it to him. You were in the chair, you heard him. You should not make reforms to the DPC. You should make decisions, you should rule, you should decide, you should determine. I suppose that's from the right wing of the DOD. That's not the center left or the left. This, the government rules must be from the party. And then he says, with a straight face, it's absolutely incredible that you are not yet subjecting yourself to the open planning procedures of the DPC for government projects. But that's a good point, Mr. Speaker. A or B? Should we subject ourselves to the planning process? Or should we rule and determine? Was the sunboard a done deal? Or should it in fact always have been a done deal because we should never have gone to planning even for guidance and advice? And which is it? You cannot have them both. I don't know if it is, in fact, just political schizophrenia of the worst sort. I'm going to say both things. There might be people out there that want to hear one of them and who are stupid enough not to say, not to see the guys say both the thing they like and the thing they don't like. Actually, the point is more such a speaker. When they tell us, I'm so long to say, should rule, should determine, but you have to consult. And then when you consult, they say, you didn't have any plans that you thought out because you changed and were involved in the consultation process. What is this? The Twilight Zone. I mean, the old gentleman can play all of these games. Of course he can. All he likes. But he's only going to convince the permanently lobotomized that he is a serious politician. What a serious way to do business in the town. I am on the issue of the town farm. He doesn't have the courtesy to tell the House that that is in the sense of a client of his. But there is one clear thread in his speech. And I'm grateful for the clarity of it, because I'm now going to amplify it for the whole community. The DSG continues to believe this is not an issue on which they have repositioned themselves, that the government should not subject itself to the process of planning, and that we must shut the doors of the process again as soon as possible. At last, in that speech, at last, it sounded like the same old DSG. I was almost astounded for it. So, with that honesty, we will amplify during the course of the next few days in the context of the by-election campaign that GSP policy continues to be to reverse all progress in respect of the DPC. The option said, the DPC gets in the way of things. I suppose the consultation also gets in the way of things. Publicity gets in the way of things. And if the first consultation means today in the DSD what it meant before in the DSD, where's the chance? We're going to demolish them. Well, please go, that's where Nelson Mitchell's victory. Hold it on. Consultation a la DSD. How do you reach new heights of political ridicule? I almost listened because the Honourable Gentleman had picked up a red nose and put it on when he said, with a straight face, that one of the problems with getting office development going is the position of the DSD. Or he acknowledged the measure that I had brought in. He can check and start if he can't remember. The impositions of the DPC are stopping office development. Mr. Speaker, if Sir Peter Kawana had been here to hear that, I think he would have gone yellow. And he went the day that Mr. Nedda said what he said about the press. Because you see, it was the Honourable Lord, the back bencher, who was very clear here in saying that the only thing stopping office development in Travolta was that banks weren't lending. And that's why he was making the equity investment in the mid-town development, which we criticised. I mean, things just get curiouser and curiouser. We're not supposed to be involved in the financial services industry in our community. Everyone knows these things. Everybody I talk to knows these things. and give to the government as the deputy chief minister said repeatedly about the banks, the lenders that will lend. But this is unrelated to Gibraltar and Gibraltar property, but they won't lend because of constraints on them from outside. And that was the position of your previous chief minister as well. But then when the ridicule was just getting impossible to bear, and I was feeling almost ashamed for him, because I still have some affection for him, he took the whole thing to a different height. But I thought I had misled him. But the Chronicle today very kindly set out what he said in black and white. And I'm sure the Panorama and other newspapers will pick it up and adopt it. He said, when Gibraltar delivers the change in the shape of Gibraltar's first one-term government and returns the GSV to office in 2015, I bet that sounded good when he was writing it, Mr. Speaker. Right sort of tone to take on a new government. Anyone with the most minor interest in local politics will know that Gibraltar's first one-term government, if you want to call it that, at least in the time that was not Chief Minister, was led by Sir Robert Belisa, from 1969 to 1972. The AACR lost in 69 and came back in 72. If a 14-year-old had told me what the other gentleman had told me, I would forgive him. But this community needs to know the lack of basic political knowledge that the honourable gentleman has about the history of Gibraltar, the modern history of Gibraltar, when they listen to him pontificating about what the future of Gibraltar should be. And I'm going to give him some advice. Before he was undoubtedly one of the best ministers Gibraltar has ever seen, the honourable Victor Garcia was one of the best historians Gibraltar has ever seen, and he's written what is known, even in diplomatic circles, as the definitive modern political history of Gibraltar. He should read Gibraltar, the making of the people, because then he wouldn't be making these basic mistakes. But then again, I guess this is what we're in for. All of the malice and none of the brains. We need wisdom, reposition. And I was worried that young people in school didn't know about the political history of Gibraltar. Like, it was the first time in history that there are two women in the House. From parliamentarians who should know better. And then on to the places of climax. He was really on the way, he didn't just worry. Look, the only point that we wanted to make to them in respect of the process of climax is that it's not a criminal matter, it's a civil matter in the process of climax. And then, if he borrowed the check, but if it doesn't make a big fight, try to think of it a little fight. The process of climax is something that I've been raising in this House when I was in that position, and something that we are already looking at. But this newfound concern for the rule of law and law and order must be something completely newfound. Because the Honourable Mr. Fiefen in 2003 was saying in the Panorama that the fishing agreement was bad for Gibraltar because it was a taking horse through the rule of law, and now he's forgotten that. But when the Honourable Gentleman said, and very helpfully put out in today's newspaper, Gibraltar, and this is really so serious, it bears analysis, Gibraltar is falling off the wagon or veering from the course set by the GSD government back in 1996. A course away from criminality, of course, away from the easy income, easy come, easy go criminal lifestyle. He's saying that under this minister, Gibraltar is veering towards criminality, easy come, easy go criminal lifestyle. That is what he's saying. He's saying, and I will repeat it because he's saying it, Gibraltar is falling off the wagon, or veering from the course set by the GSD, our back in 1906, a course away from criminality, a course away from the easy come, easy go criminal lifestyle. If we're veering away from that course, we're veering towards it. That's what he said. Whatever our positions in respect of the fishing agreement, I have made very clear, integral and internationally, the importance of adherence to the rule of law, even if it has resulted in diplomatic incidents. That's the importance of the rule of law in Gibraltar today. Since 1999, the rule of law was something which had a massive crack in it. But what is it that makes honorable gentlemen think that we're veering off course? Is it that we have spent more money in employing police officers than they ever did? Is it that we've given more resources to the police than they ever did? Is it that we've built them more assets for their interests than they ever did? Is it that we're talking about the Customs Department becoming a law enforcement agency or recognized as being a law enforcement agency? That we're buying them vehicles for rent so they don't have to rely on confiscated vehicles? That we're buying them for vessels? Is that what makes them think? Doesn't realize the importance of what he's saying. What is an international investor going to say if he reads the certificate of his speech? Hang on a minute. Gibraltar's falling off the wagon. It's not going. What is it you're taking it? We're all going towards criminality, easy come, easy go criminal lifestyle. Everybody who reads today's Gibraltar Chronicle would take that to be the meaning of what he said. I have never heard anything more irresponsible or ridiculous put in this place by anyone. He should consider his position and resign his seat now. He shouldn't wait for the morning of after the by-election. Nobody in our community is going to accept that that was something that a parliamentarian should have said in this place today. Especially given the massive investment in the forces of law and order in our community, which goes beyond anything ever invested by any government, the huge commitment, the unimpeachable commitment in the rule of law, which they have criticized. So, frankly, Mr. Speaker, although he can pretend not to care and joke, the rest of his speech was just like the white noise that one gets when you're not able to tune a channel in on the television. Until he got to the accusation of cronyism. But this is a common GSD theme, and it has to be exposed. It's a common GSD tactic. Throw as much mud as possible. Even if it's true, some of it, even if it's untrue, some of it may stick. So, Mr. Speaker, this is the Parliament of Gibraltar on the second reading of the Bill on the Appropriation of Money for the Youth of the Year. It's not the Comedy Club. This is not Live at the Apollo, Mr. Speaker. So, I'm going to have to deal with the allegation, even though it is ridiculous. We were taking jobs for the birds. Well, it's not true, Mr. Speaker. It's not happening. We're taking jobs for Gibraltarians, regardless of their political colour. But I don't care. He just said it. He engaged brain, he engaged mouth before brain. But of course, I can't prove a negative. It's impossible to prove a negative. But I can debunk the examples that he gave of it. He talked about the Sardinia matter. What did he get? The Sardinia matter is not a piece of evidence of cronyism. It's the best possible evidence of abuse of power for the time that they were in administration, using the whole of the power of the two persons of order from number six commentary to victimize an individual. But what happened? He hasn't had an award from the Industrial Tribunal, he hasn't had a job. Where's the cronyism? That we would do a defense that costs more, much more, than the maximum the man would have got from the Industrial Tribunal. It hasn't happened yet, then it doesn't stop, Mr. Fiedler. But I'm going to do the research into the government. I've got the definition. What is the dictionary or what cronyism means? It is this: the appointment of friends to government posts without proper regard to their qualifications. Oh, my God. Do you not remember, because he was here, the question time debate, or when the speaker would write the say that we have on the question time, about the culture agency? When the editor of that center took away the list of people I gave him that he employed at other without interview, and said he was going to come back and dismiss and debunk all of that suggested that I made, and we're still waiting. But I'll tell you what I've done, Mr. Speaker. I've asked the Chief Secretary to submit a list of people who were employed without interview at the time that they were in government, in the civil service and in the public sector more generally. It's taken so long to compile, it's not yet ready. There are so many people on that list. Now, somebody's employed without interview because somebody said so, and I put it to him, Mr. Speaker, that that is cronyism. But if they think that that is not cronyism, something which has not happened since the 9th of December 2011, but maybe right before that date, I can give another few examples of cronyism a la DOD. What about the 7 days? Giving somebody who was not a journalist, no qualification, £150,000 to publish a rag every Friday saying how good they were, how bad we were, not one other advert in there that paid its way, wholly funded by the government of Gibraltar to attack the opposition. That is cronyism. In fact, they were probably written inter alia by people who are now sitting on that side of the house. That is cronyism of the worst sort. Paid to an individual who's related to somebody sitting on that side of the house. £150,000 of taxpayers' money to do their dirty partisan work. I'll tell you something, Mr. Speaker. There was a leaflet, a newsletter, ready to go out to the residents of Waterford Terraces, of Cumberland, of Bayview, of Nelsonville, telling them about the changes that were happening in their estate as a result of having to spend $10 million to fix that flatter that they left behind. I stopped it. It's not going out until after the by-election, because I didn't want it to interfere with the democratic process. You spent, when you were in power, honourable members, £150,000 on just one publication related to one of your members of the executive in this house. And then you say that people who cross that suffer consequences. Look, that was true when they were in power. Mr. Sardinia is living proof of it. Joanna Mendes is living proof of it. Thank God. So is her daughter. Vox is online proof of it. No longer print proof of it. Because all adverts were withdrawn when the editorial line turned anti-GSD. I am living and successful proof of it, Mr. Speaker. But isn't it he, my erstwhile friend, has forgotten what it was that they tried to do to me? To suffer consequences. I think it appears that I might become leader of the opposition, and whilst I was, there was a concerted effort led from number 6 Convent Place, involving, I believe, but I cannot prove, the honourable now the leader of the opposition, headed by Mr. Raphael Benzekeng, the one who took the 40 million, the legal work that we cannot find. To have me disbarred, to stop me from earning a living, to stop me from being able to pay my family's mortgage, just as they were going to Sardinia and to Hernando, just as they did to Vox. What if people suffering personal consequences as a result of crossing the GSD? That is the disgusting behavior to which they sunk. And that is the flank which he opened when he made that baseless allegation of those things having happened after the 8th of December 2008. And I'll tell him more, because he is a erstwhile friend. They didn't even have the courtesy to grant me an adjournment of the hearing the day after my father had died. But he agreed, and all members of its executive insisted that I turn up to the trumped-up charge by the Bar Council, or at the Bar Council, by them, by Mr. Benzekeng and others in the GSD, the day after my father had died. And so, Mr. Speaker, if the other gentleman wants to talk about people suffering consequences for crossing people politically, he's talking about the party he represents. Because the party I lead will never visit consequences on anybody because they cross us politically. So, finally, Mr. Speaker, despite our friendship, I was very dismayed that he demonstrated that he does not deserve to hold a seat in this parliament to represent the good people of Gibraltar. Some people are obviously just elected because of the party opposite that they carry. And if there is one thing that is true about the party system, is that he has demonstrated that if he had to stand on his own 2 feet and didn't have a 3-party initial behind his name at an election, he wouldn't be here today if that was the sort of argument he made to the general public. He did not mention, Mr. Speaker, one figure in his intervention. In this debate on the estimate, he did not mention one number. You need to come prepared for this House to discuss numbers and figures in a debate on public finances and the economy. And I say to the Honourable Gentleman, he is actually much better cast in the role, he does so well, of the bumbling comedian, rather than of the useless rogue armed with broken facts that have no basis in reality. Like the argument of the golden legacy, Mr. Speaker. This is clearly the reality of the poisoned legacy which the public will see today when I publish the financial strategy memorandum. A growing debt of decreasing usable tax reserves, not enough to get us through to the end of the financial year, which we found. Of a housing waiting list that we found that had gone up from 400 in 1988 to 1,500 when we took over. To an unemployment that was over 1,000 people in Gibraltar. That is the poison legacy that the party opposite left Gibraltar. And we must have ultimate spectacle if in that poison they see gold. Because the new, less than sophisticated slogan is Balanta, Mr. Speaker, because they don't want anybody to look back. I guess things may look golden in this twilight zone in which they operate. But perhaps the twilight is that these are the twilight years of the GSD. Although that doesn't really help to describe members opposite as a team. A twilight zone of people making facts up, which is what has characterized what we've heard. Even Mr. Bosino's intervention, completely undone by the fact that Mr. Seaton gave away during the general election campaign. The unemployment figure, obviously down by half from that 1,000, given that we've added 524 Gibraltarian jobs, and the number is down to 522. And even in the finance centre, which Mr. Figueroa said is a bit costly to draw the funding, jobs are up 200. Gross debt is down 37.5%, and net debt will be down by this time next year 10%. The minimum wage is up, but the electricity, social insurance, and rates remain static. A bigger reduction in the cost of doing business in Gibraltar and the percentage rise in the minimum wage. Tax liabilities are down on the allowance-based system, and new deductions are introduced on the gross income-based system. Allowances for the disabled are up. Personal allowances are up. And usable cash reserves are up from 20 million, or dare I say 2.1 million when we finish the year, to £85 million, 25 times the number. Nothing they have said has taken any of the sound off of this brilliant budget for our community. None of the arguments they have put have promised the clear benefits for people from across our community. This budget, Mr. Speaker, of real social justice remains a testament to our continued delivery of our manifesto commitment. That is why the work we are doing here is so welcome by many in our community. We are rightly seen by objective observers to be not a good government, Mr. Speaker, but an excellent government. And that is the work, given that they introduced this into the debate, that is the work that Albert Isola would be adding to if he's elected on Thursday to join us on the government benches. Helping to deliver lower debt, higher usable tax reserves, a lower debt city for community care and for the elderly in our community, more homes for our people, more jobs for those that need them, more investment in Gibraltar. Albert Isola is a man who's proven in business and in politics, Mr. Speaker. He's the only candidate in this election with experience of Parliament. He's the only candidate who, if he's elected, I will make a minister and will have the chance to work for our community in government. But until then, Mr. Speaker, our community cannot be without an appropriation. And nothing I have heard persuades me to do anything other than to continue to commend this bill to the House. I invite you to respect the House now until 3:15.
I now put a question in the case that a bill for an act to appropriate sums of money to the service of the year ending on the 31st day of March 2014 be read a second time. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried. The Appropriation Act 2013. May I?
All honourable members are here with us for this state to be taken later today.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today? The House now recesses to 3 p.m. for that purpose. 3:15, even better.